Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another prestige movie. Today, we're talking about Cape Fear, the 1991 version, directed by one Martin Scorsese. You know Martin Scorsese. Goodfellas, Casino, The Aviator.
Marty, as I call
Marty.
Him.
Yeah. We're friends. Screenplay by Wesley Strick, who also wrote the screenplay for Arachnophobia, Batman Returns. These films, unlike Cape Fear. He recently worked as a writer EP on The Man in the High Castle for Amazon. This is based on Cape Fear, the movie, 1962, directed by James R. Webb, based on The Executioners, a novel by John D. MacDonald. It also, interestingly, stars, the two stars of that film, the 62 version, Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck, appear in this one in minor supporting roles. It stars Robert De Niro himself as Max Cady. You know Robert De Niro. Come on.
The man, the myth, the legend, the renowned accent work voice actor, Robert De Niro.
The nine-time collaborator with Martin Scorsese. It's something crazy like that.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere between 7 and 10. Nick Nolte. Nick Nolte was in Tropic Thunder. If you've heard him speak in the last 10-15 years, you'll know it, because he sounds like he just gargles acid all day and he's always into shit.
I only know him from his mugshots. That's
true.
It.
I think that era is when he started talking like this, Jim. You know, that mugshot got out. He just didn't give a fuck no more. He actually sounds like a normal human being in this film.
Carefully, Ron. You have a full hour of podcasting to do.
I was doing some Nick Nolte runs last night, and I swear to God, something broke loose in my throat. Like, dude, that just felt like a tendon or something went twing, snap.
Woof.
I gotta be careful. I gotta baby it. Jessica Lange, American Horror Story favorite as Lee. She's the traumatized wife in this movie. Juliette Lewis, you'll never guess, plays a traumatized daughter in this movie. And Joe Don Baker. I love Joe Don Baker. Mm-hmm. He was the CIA agent handler for James Bond throughout the Pierce Brosnan era. He essentially plays the character of Mitchell from the classic Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode covering Mitchell. And there's other people, but this is the cast. Jim, have you seen Cape Fear, either edition, before? And what did you make of it this time around?
No, I have not. I have not seen the 62 version or the 91 version. I will say I didn't care much for this movie. It's okay. I think the thing that supports it at all here and makes it worth my time to watch and not just want to shut it off is Robert De Niro's performance. Maybe barring his accent, I don't like his accent. I think it's an odd choice of actor if you really want this guy to be Southern, and it's an odd choice to make Robert De Niro Southern if you really want Robert De Niro. So it was weird. But Robert De Niro is great in this. He is terrifying. Most of the time he did a lot of work, I guess, pre-production in order to make himself and during production, actually, to make himself a lot more intimidating looking by putting on a ton of muscle, and it worked. Juliette Lewis equally is awesome in this movie, not because she's terrifying, but because she's playing so innocent at the beginning of this movie and then so just terrorized by Robert De Niro at the end. She's great. I've always liked Juliette Lewis, especially in Natural Born Killers. That's probably her standout for me. The plot of this movie, I get what it's about. It's about, like, injustice in the justice system, I suppose. But I felt like it was a little bit clumsy in that regard, and ultimately a little gratuitous to make its point well, I think. But I don't know. How'd you feel about it?
I thought it was pretty dumb. I thought it was pretty stupid. Like, at various points in this film, I'm just like, I don't believe you're playing into this guy's hands. You know, like, there's like, oh, he's just doing such a good job of staying this side of the law. And I'm like, is he?
It's the stuff with Lori that really,
man,
like,
Yeah.
And it's kind of the point of the movie, but also I don't know if I buy it.
I think they fucked up. They went a little too far on some of these supposedly on the line crimes to really mm-hmm. make me feel, because you're supposed to feel like you're in this pressure cooker where you've got this violent psychopath who is essentially doing the Big Brother version of the I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you.
The legal kind of like.
Yeah. You're being tormented by your brother or sister, and they're not really bothering you, but they're fucking bothering you. And it's like you're supposed to think of like this lawyer who, you know, is like the law being used as a shackle against him. He can't protect his family. I just didn't. And then the last minute twist of like, oh, you weren't as good a defense lawyer as you could have been. It's like it didn't really hit for me, because I'm like, well. It sounds like you raped that 16-year-old girl, Robert.
Yeah.
Sounds like you needed to go. And look what you're doing now. Looks like we shouldn't have let you out. Like, there wasn't like
this.
I'm starting
to come around on this vigilante justice thing.
Yeah.
Because of you. Because look what you're doing.
Yeah. It's like, I don't. And that's not normally movies that move me more towards a conservative reactionary viewpoint, but congratulations, Cape Fear. You got me there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of curious choices because the whole story behind this is Martin Scorsese made The Last Temptation of Christ, which is this deeply personal, pan-offensive work about obviously the Christ. And he too made a deal with the studio that if you let me do this, then I'll do a conventional studio picture for you. Mm-hmm. Somehow he wound it up. This is also was interesting because it's all bound up in Schindler's List. Somehow he was going to make the studio picture of Schindler's List, and he didn't feel right about it. So, and Steven Spielberg had Cape Fear, so just like, hey, you know what? Let's trade.
And Spielberg got the best of that deal.
I do. But like, I don't think that, and it's not that I don't think Martin Scorsese didn't give a shit. This wasn't a passion project for him. Like, I think he picked something that I think he was a little intrigued by the classic Cape Fear. I think he wanted to make like a Hitchcock style thriller. And I think he also made the mistake of maybe biting Hitchcock a little too hard. And there's this, I've been working on this theory. I'm going to debut it on this podcast called the Uncanny Cinema Valley, where like, we as a modern audience have an easier time being entertained by something like Citizen Kane, by Casablanca, by Maltese Falcon, something that's very, very old and recognizably. Then, like, sometimes you get some of this stuff that's like mid-80s to early 90s, and it's like recognizably modern but extremely dated because of its either sensibilities or its filmmaking techniques. And just like, you know, the Uncanny Valley is this theory that, like, you have fully realistic humans and they're not creepy at all. And, like, you got Mickey Mouse cartoons and they're not creepy at all. But, like, the weird CG Polar Express kind of Zemeckis shit that they were doing where it's, like, 90% of a human but dead eyes or whatever, and it just strikes you as creepy. I feel like there's this where it's, like, there's something about this era of film stock and acting and the general kind of gross sensibilities that is harder to be entertained by than something like Citizen Kane. And I think this movie falls squarely into that uncanny valley where, like, maybe 20, 30 years from now, it'll be something where it's like, oh, look at this crazy, weird Scorsese movie. But now it's like, except for extreme fans of Scorsese and maybe Hitchcock and people that want to compare the two filmmaking techniques, I don't know why anyone would watch this for fun. Except for...
Sure.
It is kind of an important piece of Robert De Niro's filmmaking because, you know, I've seen Robert De Niro be terrifying a dozen different ways. This is a new one. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, what he's done, like how he sculpted his body. The accent work didn't bother me. I don't know why.
I don't know why it bothers me, I guess.
Sounded like the main guy of shit that S-Town serial podcast. Okay. It's like, you know, kind of like, I feel like sometimes you get a swishy kind of southern accent that it comes out this way, but he's fantastic, and he makes a lot of stuff work that I don't think should work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
But yeah. Yeah.
I was super worried about the sensibilities, especially when it comes to sexuality and the justice system and women throughout the beginning of this movie. I think they come around on it to a place of reason, but boy, I was really shaky at the beginning of this. There's a lot of weird stuff. There's also weird stuff that is just unresolved that maybe we could talk about in the spoilers.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know that this is a movie I ever care to revisit. But I guess I'm glad I've seen the De Niro performance.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like I've checked off another Scorsese. It is an intriguing, broad but intriguing and committed De Niro performance. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good Nick Nolte too. Actually, everyone does a really good job at what they're doing. It's just like what they're doing is not great.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I needed it.
The thing that I guess that has to work for this movie, you know, we talk about like that you got to feel like that De Niro's Katie has got Nick Nolte's characters completely boxed in. And I feel like that just a ton of errors on Nick Nolte's part, like in Air's relationship with his, like it made him uniquely vulnerable to. Like, his family was already divided against him before this started. And then you add, you add Max Cady to it. And it's just like, finishes doing the job. But it bugs me because I felt like there's just so many things that were, you know, Nick Nolte just did a terrible job of, like, empathizing with his family. Like, I didn't feel bad for him because I felt like, well, you just keep on fucking things up, man. You just keep fucking things up. And maybe that's the point. You know, that this guy has corroded his family. But then I think it also plays false because at the end, like the family's brought closer together and they act like, oh, we went on from that day and we never talked about it again. And we're like, that felt very false to me. This felt like a family that was already fractured and something like this would just blow the lid off. And instead it brings, and I'm like, so I thought the end note was also false. Like the end is ridiculous. The end of this movie is ridiculous, and then when it ended in like this weird dead-eyed monotone monologue from Juliette Lewis about how the family went on as a nuclear, I don't know man.
Yeah, it's just Scorsese, you know, voiceover kind of thing,
and it's all like that's you. Classic Scorsese, the guilt and shame and how it weighs on you and how it, but it's like this scenario just didn't seem, nothing about it seemed as compelling as, you know, you put this up against Departed, you put this up against Casino, up against Goodfellas, Raging Bull. It just doesn't hold a candle. The Aviator, like literally this is my least favorite Scorsese film that I've seen. There's a bunch I haven't seen still because
Age of Innocence is not my favorite Scorsese film.
I don't know. That shit worked. Like in that very particular, like if he tried to make that movie set in the 1990s, I'd be like, well, okay, true.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't want to relitigate the Downton Abbey of it all, but
yeah, go listen to it.
Go listen to our Age of Innocence podcast.
Yep.
What should we do? Should we talk? Do we have, I thought another interesting thing about this movie, is it's got a score that was originally written by Bernard Herrmann for the 1962 Cape Fear, and it was lightly reworked and updated by Elmer Bernstein. So like you are listening to, and it sounds like it, that's another thing that gives it that kind of Hitchcock feel, is this authentic 60s thriller soundtrack.
Yeah, the Hitchcock of it all doesn't really work for me. Like you said, it's too thin. It's like I never felt like the legal trappings were being indicted here, right? Like the idea that Robert De Niro, I don't know, maybe if Robert De Niro had if Katie had worked faster to get into this guy's life, I would believe that the legal system was too cumbersome and slow to respond to a threat like that, but he takes weeks to get going here. I think a guy like Nick Nolte, a high power lawyer, could absolutely get a restraining order, could do all the things he needs to do legally, get his ducks in a row in that amount of time. Now that wouldn't stop a guy like Max Cady, right? That's not that's not the point.
But then you got the pretext to get him rearrested and thrown back in jail.
Sure.
Like, if he's violating the terms of a, you know...
Probably out on parole, probably a violation of that. He'd be in for a lot longer. Yeah, there's you can get him off your case here. But I never felt like that was a thing. It was like, okay, he's sitting on a property line on a fence. Yeah, I guess he knows that legally he can't trespass, but who doesn't know that, right? He didn't feel like a legal mastermind to me. Mm-hmm. He felt like a guy who knew just enough... Just a normal dude who knew anything about the law whatsoever, being a terrorist against his family. That part didn't work when they're trying to make him like, oh my God, he's so smart legally. He's outmaneuvering me at every turn. I never felt that.
Yeah, even the intro to Katie, it's like he's doing these dips in prison, and you just see this giant muscled back of Robert De Niro, but like it's panning over this bookshelf that he's got, and he's just got like the Communist Manifesto and War and Peace, and he's got pinups of Pinochet and Mussolini. He's just like all over, like, where the fuck are you
and
intellectually?
Crosses and Confederate shit and Nazi stuff, and it's like, you've just adopted every nasty philosophy I can think of.
Exactly.
And it comes off as a cartoon, honestly.
He's the living embodiment of like horseshoe theory. It's like,
No, what's that?
I just like that if you get to the extremes of the left and right, that they eventually bend back into like some kind of authoritarian fascism. I don't personally subscribe to it myself, but like this guy, clearly, it's like... reads the Communist Manifesto, is like, oh, it sounds pretty good, redistribution, and he reads Mein Kampf, fucking hate the Jews, and it's just like there's no underlying
he's a joke, he's not a real person, and that hurts the film, I think, ultimately.
Shall we get to the, is there anything else we need to... Oh, I want to say something about the Hitchcock stuff that's not working for you. I think we talked about this in the... What was the last? Was it Rearview Mirror that... Rear window? The Rear Window. Why do I always want to put view? The Rear Window. Is that the one that opens with the big tracking shot of the established location in the city? I think it does. And we talked about, like, that's such a... Like, you start off with 5 miles away, and you just kind of, like this zoom in on this apartment. And, like, that's a very impressive and immersive shot back in the day. And you can still kind of admire it with, like, God, how did he pull that off? He doesn't have, like, helicopter this and that. He just kind of, like, did this practically, painstakingly. There's a few shots like that in this film, but it loses all that, like, oh, wow, how did you do it charm? Because it's just like, I'm doing this weird Hitchcock stuff. I'm doing negative exposures, and I'm doing, going to do a color wash on it. And it's like, well, it's 1991. You could do a better job, Marty.
Yeah, you could actually Park. Look at the state of the art, man.
Right.
It's
Terminator 2
just flipping
is contemporary
film
of this movie. This isn't like 1981, and there's just a lot. But I think that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to go for that very particular 60s kind of Hitchcockian thriller, and he wanted to make it, I understand the original is more like what we were thinking it's going to be, like a good man who's just being harassed within the bounds of a law by a psychopath. And Martin Scorsese takes this as like, well, what I want to make sure my Catholic guilt and shame are in there, and I want that to be, I don't want Nick Nolte to be a good man. I want him to be a flawed man who's being brought down by his flaws, and the reason his family's not on his side is because he's not faithful to him, and he's this and like, I don't know. I feel like you maybe needed to pick one of those things, or maybe I don't. But like I said, it's a $30 million movie he shot for Universal as a favor because they let him do his weird Jesus film. Do we have any non-spoiler things we want to talk about, or should we get to the spoiler stuff?
I want to say I think it's a mistake to try to make Martin Scorsese do a mainstream film. Why would you? I mean, the guy doesn't make these kind of movies. Why would you try and force him into this mold? Why not just give this to some other director who does a more traditional job? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Did you read Roger Ebert's review?
I read the highlights, not all of it. No,
fully half, like the second half was just him saying that, like, why are we doing, like, this is a fine movie, but why are we doing this? This is the greatest living director we have working at this time. He's in the middle of the most interesting phase of his career. This is contemporary, and this isn't a,
it's like Casino, why era, right?
Yeah, why? Yes, he made Goodfellas, I think, the year before this. Like, why the hell are we making him do this kind of shoddy remake, you know? He's like, hey, it's getting good reception. It's getting good review. Obviously, it gained some Oscar stuff. This isn't a trash movie. It's just extraneous. Is that the right word for it?
I suppose, yeah.
It'd be like taking LeBron James and having him play curling. As a gifted athlete, I'm pretty sure he could give curling a great shot. You know, but like, why would you do that?
It's like taking Michael Jordan and making him play baseball.
Why would you do that?
In that case, you couldn't stop him. But yeah
that's because he was being punished by the NBA commissioner for his many gambling crimes. But yeah. Anyway, shall we get to the description of what the movie's about?
Yeah, let's do it.
This movie's about a lawyer played by Nick Nolte. I went for the impression, and my throat said no, and I had to bail. I had to bail in the first syllable. Nick Nolte is a lawyer who 17 years ago defended Robert De Niro's Max Cady for the assault and rape of a 16-year-old. The unsuccessful defense, which led to him going to prison for 17 years. And he has been released on parole, and he has decided to move to Nick Nolte's hometown and get to know his family. That's the setup of the movie. Sure. That's not like, you know, and he introduces himself, says hi, and, you know, it's kind of weird and off-putting, but he can't, it's not illegal. It's not illegal to say hi to your old defense attorney. He's just out taking a stroll, and that's the whole movie. And it goes wild places. I think you either know now whether you want to see it again or you want to see it for the first time. Check it out if you do. No skin off my nose and or back if you don't. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move. I'm worried that we won't have much to say in the spoiler section because I feel like we've talked about the whole thing.
I got some more stuff to say for sure.
I want to talk about, we talked about the Hitchcock of it. There is some just cheesy shot compositions. Like, what is going on with this sky? Like, Martin Scorsese is green screening and running, I think, the original Quake skybox for North Carolina for this entire movie. That scene, like, where we first meet Robert De Niro and he's walking out of prison, I think he actually bumps into the camera on that take, but the storm that's you didn't notice anything about the fucking sky?
I noticed there was a storm coming in at one point during the movie, but no.
Oh, there's this, it's just badly composited. Like, the sky looks like when they open the box of the Covenant, the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Raiders. Like, it's just unnatural. And they repeat that again and again and again. And Yeah, I just thought they were extremely cheesy. And that Robert De Niro stalking towards, it's like, that was kind of menacing, but I do feel like the last five frames of that shot are Robert De Niro's left nostril hitting the camera lens and being deformed by it. Like, it was wild.
I mean, maybe that's why you hire Scorsese, for shots like that, you know, avant-garde.
They're inventive, that's for sure.
Yeah. No one's ever seen that particular side of Robert De Niro's nostril. I don't know, he really looks like a dirtbag, you know? The way he holds himself, the tattoos he has, De Niro does a great job transforming not just his physical presence, but also his how intimidating he is. It's a different kind of intimidating. It's a guy who's physically imposing at this point. Yeah. and walks and carries himself as such.
Yeah.
It's not something I see a lot from De Niro. I see him being intimidating because of his will and his presence as like a dangerous guy, but not a physically intimidating, not a guy who could grab you and like tear you into pieces.
Or maybe he could, because certainly like Raging Bull, De Niro.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's the
but
exception.
Like, he's like, usually De Niro in these movies, like in Scorsese movies, is crude up. He wouldn't have to. Like he
yeah,
might
have
this,
Joe Pesci,
you know,
do it or something.
Yeah, exactly. He's got he's powerful in ways beyond his physicality. And here it's just he is a street tough, essentially. It's had 17 years to earn a law degree and to read the Communist Manifesto in prison. But he's also just, yeah, like there's also a certain amount of like charm to De Niro in this movie, except for the scene or two that he's trying to seduce Juliette Lewis. He's just offensive. He's just crude.
Yeah.
Loud, boorish, presumptive. And it's all to, you know, get the goat of Nick Nolte.
Yeah, there's one other scene that I really think he stands out in, and it's that scene. Well, I mean, he stands out in a lot of scenes, but the one that is kind of a different side of him, like the charming side, is the one with Lori in the bar where she's like clearly very drunk and he is, he knows what he's going to do to her, and he comes across as charming, but like in a very disturbed kind of way. Like if she weren't drunk, she should be picking up on a lot of signals here that this man is very nasty. Not nearly as charming as he's pretending to be. And Robert De Niro plays that perfectly.
I think that kicks off one of the biggest flaws of the movie, which is like, this was an early provocation. I think it was like, he said hi, he sat on their fence, and then he grabbed Lori and he rapes her.
Right.
And you have to believe that like he is calculatingly doing all these things to maximally offend Nick Nolte, but to stay on the right side of the law. And he calculates that she will be so embarrassed by the potential revelation that Nick Nolte and her are having an extramarital affair that she will say mum about the rape, which I would almost buy, except for the sheer violence. Like, he bites her cheek off, physically disfigures her for all time, to the extent that she ends up moving to back home to the East Coast after this. And her stated reason for not going to the cops to report this is because she's afraid what the local legal community will think of her. Mm-hmm. Like, that, I mean,
this is where the movie almost gets to a point, but it's too cartoonish. It's too over the top with it.
This argument doesn't stand against itself. It's like, I cannot face my peers in the community. They can't know that I've been raped. By the way, my face is half missing, and also I'm moving home and I'm never going to see them again. So like the reason she states that she's not going to testify is completely undone like 5 minutes later. And I'm like,
so it's not just about like the reputational damage she'll suffer, but it's the act of going through it. And that's where I think the movie has a point. Because up to this point, I was kind of despising the character's sensibilities on sex in this movie. Like,
yes,
there's Nick Nolte, right? Is the whole reason that this Katie thing is happening is because he hid a report. He buried a report that said the woman that Robert De Niro, the girl, the 16-year-old girl that Robert De Niro beat and raped to go to prison, was actually promiscuous, right? She had three sexual partners in a month.
Right.
And so he buried that and as evidence in Robert De Niro, which is the implication there is that a woman who is promiscuous cannot possibly be raped. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this movie has gone off the fucking reservation, man. It's
sure. That's what I'm saying. It
has some wild ideas. But then Lori comes along and I'm like, okay, she's putting voice to everything that I was thinking in those previous scenes about how ridiculous and heinous and shitty that attitude is.
Uh-huh.
And so the movie kind of won me back over, at least on that point, when Lori says it. So I get it, right? She doesn't want to have testify
that's the thing. It's like,
and have her sexuality like mocked and be judged for it and tell the tale in lurid details, right? Like, she doesn't want to go through that. It's not just about like, my reputation's going to be harmed.
Yeah, and that's the uncanny valley, because like the unspoken thing we're talking about here, and in 1991, an audience would buy that in 1973, man can rape a 16-year-old girl, and because she's had three sexual experiences in a month, that she's just a slut, and who cares? She's like, and I'm like, okay, maybe I buy that. I have a hard time buying that even in 1991 that a woman's going to go into court with her face beaten to hell, her arm broken, and her left cheek bit off. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be like, well, Mrs. Jane or Lori David, what skirt? How much did you have to drink tonight? What skirts? Like, no one can possibly fucking consent. This is like, leave the sexual shit out of it. It's just criminal. It's just criminal assault. You couldn't do this in a boxing ring to somebody.
Sure, but that's not what she's worried about. She's not worried whether the jury will convict this guy or not.
No, she's worried about the prosecutors going to say, like, going to say these ridiculous things, like, oh, well, what are we drinking? What are you I guess the defense attorney's going to, you know, which is the thing that...
Well, they will. They will. I mean, that's part of the defense, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, look... It's not unheard of.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, you're arguing a movie's point. I'm just like, this stuff all was completely baffling to me.
So I think they shouldn't have made it as insane as it is, right? Like, everything in this movie is over the top, and I think that hurts it ultimately.
Right.
While we're talking about the sexuality stuff, one more thing here, maybe multiple things. There's a lot of sexuality in this, but... Wow. Another fucked up thing that they never correct in this movie is when Juliette Lewis comes to her mom, who's painting or whatever, doing artwork for logos.
Yeah, she's a commercial artist.
She's talking about like people flashing her, and Juliette Lewis is like, oh, you think I've never been flashed? And her mom's like, fine. I didn't mean to insult you. Of course, I'm sure you've been flashed before. I'm like, wow, that is a wild thing to teach your daughter, that the highest compliment you can be paid is for someone to whip their dick out in front of you.
Right.
What are we talking about, movie? And they never address that. That's just like left to stand on its own.
Yeah. Yeah. God, everything else is variations of stuff we've already talked about.
And then there's...
Well, let me ask, so there's a lot of things also like that are like, how does Jessica Lange not know that it's Max Katie she's talking to when he's outside her gate? Like, there's a 5-minute sequence where the tension is like, oh, she doesn't know that she's being charmed by you've seen him at the theater, you saw him on the wall of your estate, you've seen him multiple times. Like, what, how the fuck did this guy, this just heavily tattooed prison guy, roll up on you and just start a conversation? You treat him like he's a southern gentleman until, like, oh my god, you must be that Max Katie. I resent what you're trying to do to me, sir. You know, retire to your couch because you caught the vapors. It's just, I don't know, man. A lot of scenes like that were just really stupid.
I agree. If I'm trying to like defend this movie somehow, and I wouldn't care to, but if I'm playing devil's advocate, she's only seen him from the back. And she saw him from the front, but it was like during fireworks. So like it was like a strobe light kind of thing. And he was wearing glasses, and every outfit that he shows up in is more ridiculous than the last. It's kind of hilarious. In that scene where he's on the wall, he's in like a boat captain's hat and a patterned. Dude,
yeah, he shows up looking like all five of the village shirt. People sometimes, I think. It's just.
Yeah, or like he pulled your granddad's 1950s leisure wear out of the closet and he's just wearing that. It's.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
Like, did you stop? Okay, you were reading a lot of shit in prison. Maybe you should have picked up a fashion magazine because, boy, you are out of fashion, dude.
What do you think is Mrs. Doubtfire turn?
Oh, my. He's been practicing in prison? I get it. Okay, you know, Bubba did his thing with you, but does that make you more qualified to pretend to be a woman in that scene?
Dude. And the thing is like, I rewound that because I'm like, wow, they passed off. They made it clear that that Robert De Niro had murdered her and wore her clothes. And I'm like, wow, they passed off Robert De Niro as his housekeeper. And is dark and in the background, but like I didn't even fucking notice. And like he gave a vocal performance that was like really. And I rewound it like two. And I'm like, no, that's the actress that is the housekeeper, and she steps off frame, and then Robert De Niro comes in. Like I felt like that was a little shitty. That's a little. I don't know. That's a little pulling one over on the audience. And for what? Because all you need to do is sell the fact that like. Nick Nolte would walk past his housekeeper out of the corner of his eye and not notice anything amiss. Like, why not have Robert De Niro wearing the dress back there and in the wig?
Yeah, you could actually do that. Pull a fast one on the audience and they go, wow, I didn't even notice. Boy, yeah. Nick Nolte might not have noticed.
But they fucking, I don't know. They, it just kind of seemed ridiculous. And also, like, man, the one thing I thought would be cool, because I've seen this, you know, I feel like I've seen this movie because if you've seen the Slideshow Bob episode of The Simpsons where he's trying to kill Bart because Bart framed him, put him in prison. This is at Cape Fear.
Yeah.
Down to him hitching a ride on the underside of the vehicle. I thought in context of the film, this would make a lot more sense, but I think I'm to understand that Max Cady clung to the underside of their vehicle for like 100 miles.
However far from their house to Cape Fear.
And he has maybe an inch and a half of clearance. In fact, I was actually scared for whoever that stuntman was because when they pulled out of that gas station, they came very close to just sandwiching him between the frame, and they're driving this like utility vehicle. It's like jacked off the ground like 18 inches. It's supposed to be menacing, but it just came across stupid to me.
Yeah, same here. There's a lot of stuff like that, like a lot of stuff at the end comes off as just over the top and dumb when it's supposed to be scary. I don't know.
Can we talk about Joey Don Baker?
Sure.
Yeah. This guy drinking Jack Daniels and Pepto-Bismol, again, hilarious. I love when Nick Nolte comes to him and wants a gun, and he's like, whoa, you know anything about a gun? And Nick Nolte's like, no. And he's like, all right, settle down, I'll get you a gun. I don't know. There's just like something really funny. The monofilament wire. But that seemed just really ridiculous. Like this, like your whole stakeout of this house is just staring at this teddy bear and waiting for it to twitch.
I love it. He stared at that thing for like 2 days straight.
The guy has the focus of a Superman. Because I thought the thing was he's going to fall asleep. Because how the hell does anyone stare at a teddy bear in the dark without falling asleep? But no. And then, like, as soon as it starts moving, Joe Don Baker hitting the floor, rolling around with that snub nose 38 out, just. Commando crawling with his big old gut. It's funny.
There are some other definite like what the fucks. You talked about Lee not realizing who Cady was. Did Cady really not know that Sam had a daughter? He has done all this research on him, found out that he's got a mistress, found out that he's that his wife does sketches, like all these different things that he knows about this family, but not that they have a 16-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
That they take to school every morning, he sees them come out of the driveway, you know, like how does he not know this? Cause he's so shocked when she runs up on the yard and he's like, oh, what? A daughter?
They also did a pretty poor job of convincing me that Juliette Lewis, because they're like, oh, they're always talking like Juliette Lewis is this Hellraiser, you know, because she,
I guess she has smoked a slightly, weed once, maybe?
She smoked, yeah, she got caught at weed, as with weed as a 16-year-old in high school. She, like, made passing fun of her mom's, you know, like that whole thing where Jessica Lange's like, she was switched to birth. It's like, she had a slightly skewed take on your logo work, lady, but they're always talking like she's like this wild child. And like, this is a time where like Juliette Lewis had, because like if Hollywood needed, we need a damaged young girl to be extremely sexualized. Who are we going to call? Central Cat, Juliette Lewis. Every fucking time, Juliette Lewis. I don't feel like the movie did a good enough job painting the fact that she is so fucking wild and so rebellious and so out to show her dad that she would consider dating this guy who she knows is terrorizing the family. Like, I kind of bought it, like, oh, that she is having this improper dalliance with the drama teacher. But as soon as she finds out, oh, you're Max Cady, you're the guy who's been terrorizing my dad, then she starts sucking his thumb and shit. Like, man, you just seem like you're that crazy.
Doesn't she, like, cry about it after that scene?
Well, but when her dad's, like, shaking her and she's, like, being coy and smiley
that's not
about
what I meant.
It.
I thought she ran off crying from that scene. Am I wrong about that?
Well, but he kind of humiliates her because, like, when he does, like, the Prince Damon thing where he's got, like, I'm fucking sexually awakening you. I'm setting your sexual alarm clock and it's ringing. And it's like, you know, she's, like, all hot and bothered. And then he just, like, drops her, like, cold takes off.
But then in the next scene, she's all about it again.
So she was hurt. Yeah. Her feelings were hurt. Like, she, you know, she's being emotionally manipulated by this guy. But,
sure.
Like,
I guess
again,
she's in turmoil.
If they had kept it like, I am your drama teacher and we're just doing drama teacher, like, I would fully buy that. But, like, I don't know.
I think it's super weird. What school, maybe we should talk about this scene. What school has their theater in the basement? Like, it's a multi-story amphitheater, but it's in the fucking basement. You have to crawl past steaming, dripping pipes to get to the door of this fucking theater. That is not how anything works.
No.
But this movie wants me to believe it. It's all for effect. Like, oh, you're going into this dangerous place. No.
Yeah, it's literally like she's going into this. Even the set that they have on is like this twisted, demented version of an enchanted fairy tale forest.
The dark
woods.
Like,
it's like literally the dark...
Dark forest, whatever he calls it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of crazy. And then she doesn't know the breed of the family dog. This kills me. They act like this... Throughout this movie, I'm wondering, is Juliette Lewis... what is her name? Danny? Is Danny like Nick Nolte's daughter, but not Lee's daughter? Because she doesn't know like the breed of the dog, but her mom is super affected by the dog's death, right? It's like she's crying and sobbing and just leaking all over the place when she's talking about it. And Juliette Lewis is sitting there like a stone. She doesn't give a shit about this dog that has been with the family for a decade. Who knows how long? Long enough for a mom to like be distraught over it. She doesn't even know what breed it is.
Like that's the mom's pet. Like no one else loves this dog.
But it's been in this house for 16 years with this girl. Yeah. What the fuck? It doesn't make any sense.
Can I ask you, like, what do you think about the payoff of the piano wire?
Not as compelling or interesting as I had hoped.
No,
he strangled him with that wire from 15 scenes ago.
Yes, that's the thing. It's like Nick Dolte's like playing the piano. He's like, wait, what? One, there's this thing's out of tune. What? There's a whole piano wire missing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, this is going to. And then it's like Don Joe Baker's like mono. I was like, is it going to come back with the monofilm? Like, I don't know. And then he just gets garroted by it. Like literally an hour later in the movie.
No, nothing in this movie was as clever. And so I heard.
And at that time,
readings,
it's like well, we know that he broke in like. It's weird because, like, there's all this mystery about whether he's actually getting inside the house or there's some other way that he's doing this. Like, how is he poisoning the dog? How's he doing that? Mm-hmm. They reveal for once and for all that, yes, he is in fact getting into the house, but he's actively in the house strangling the guy when they reveal it. It's like, what?
Yeah, and they never reveal, like, how he got into the house. It's just like, because they make it seem like, oh, he's got some secret way to get in. How is he doing it? He just gets in.
He does a lot of that.
They never tell you, like, how, like, why was it special? Why couldn't we tell how he was getting in this house?
Yeah. There's a lot of that where it's like he's almost supernaturally good at, like, human engineering. You know, he can get in and talk, like, how does he get the list of students? How does he get the faculty list at the school? How does he? And I guess things weren't as hard a target as they are nowadays. And it's still shockingly easy to socially engineer people. But he's just like, kind of like, oh shit, what's his name in season one of Fargo? Billy Bob Thornton. He's like Billy Bob Thornton in season, like, he's almost supernaturally good at the things he's doing. Like, he can just appear and disappear like smoke.
Yeah. Yeah, it is weird.
Do you know what part of the movie I really enjoyed? Nick Nolte slipping in a pool of blood and busting his ass. And I think
rolling around in it.
Was that supposed to happen?
Like in the script?
Yeah. Did he slips on the blood? Because he busted his ass. Yeah. It was the most one of the most violent slip and falls I've seen this side of Chuck and Better Call Saul.
No, I was laughing too hard to note how violent of a fall it was, because boy, it's hilarious.
It's a slapstick. It's really funny.
And the way he, you know, rolls around it and stuff. And then I'm thinking at, like, okay, now you're in trouble, right? You've got a dead man in your house. His blood is all over your clothes. You just picked up the gun, which is the murder weapon, ran out into the yard and fired several shots with it. So your fingerprints are all over it. Bloody fingerprints. You're in trouble. And that's when they run. And I'm like, okay, he's the fugitive, right? Actually, he's way crazier than the fugitive. Not even Richard Kimball ran to a fucking swamp in the middle of nowhere on a houseboat, right? To evade the law. He just kind of, like, went to a dingy basement. Boy, he really takes his vigilante hiding seriously.
Did you catch that when Juliet Lewis ran to her room when her family, her mom and dad were fighting and screaming, and she goes and she turns on MTV and she cranks the volume? They were playing Jane's Addiction, Caught Stealing, but that was not what was coming out of the speakers. What the fuck? Did they lose the rights to that music in between production and release? Did they lose it in between 1991 and 2020? Because I've heard that's like, if you want to stream a movie that was at least made in North America in the last 30, 40 years, and mysteriously you can't anywhere, you can't even buy it, it's almost always because a very complicated music rights issue that didn't cover streaming. Or the one that comes to mind is Pump Up the Volume, the Christian Slater. We did that a couple years back, and it's like you have to pirate that movie if you want to watch it. Because it's illegal to release that movie in any form.
Digitally, at least. Music video games, the like Rock Bands and Guitar Heroes of the world, those are really hard to re-release or to keep online because of the music rights.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. So it was weird. I noticed that immediately. I'm like, oh, I've seen that music video. It's Jane's Addiction, Caught Stealing.
They showed like where the dude's like slipping pineapple up his vagoo. It's like, that's very If you're watching MTV in the early 90s, like, yeah, that's a frame that you're gonna remember.
Absolutely. I know this song. It's Patience by Guns N' Roses. The two are not the same.
No.
My headcanon is that she is just a girl who listens to the radio while watching MTV on mute. That's my headcanon for this girl. She's some kind of true psychopath. Like, in my head, this is Juliette Lewis saying, nah, I need to be weirder. Let me watch Jane's Addiction while listening to Guns N' Roses.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe she makes mixtapes where she's like, you know what? This music video doesn't go with this song.
That's so avant-garde as fuck, man.
Yeah,
I love that.
Hell yeah. She's remixing the shit out of music
videos. Mixed VHS tapes. Hell yeah. Nobody ever made me a mixed VHS tape.
Why didn't? Yeah. Why didn't you make, why didn't we make music video mixes for our boy and girlfriends back in the day?
Because they didn't have VHS Walkmans. If they had had like personal, private...
A double deck VCR where you could actually have one tape and then another that you're... Because like that's making a mixtape was hell unless you had a double-headed...
Because otherwise you're trying to listen to the radio and got your finger on the thing, but you always got the annoying DJ who's like, man, you're cutting off the first 15 seconds of this song and the last like minute and a half of it. Come on, dude.
Yeah, and you're gonna beep all the swears. And
well, I was thinking of it from the other side where like the mixtape is a very personal, private thing, right? You don't want to go into the living room and for your entire family play the mixtape that your boyfriend made for you when it's got fucking Genuine's Pony on it or some shit. So that wasn't possible with a VHS.
This was an era where having your own television in your room was a big deal, let alone the whole television VCR, entertainment center complex.
Just not private enough.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Glad we talked that through together. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the final act of this film? There is some perfect storm.
Oh my God.
Only shitty things with this houseboat. This clearly model houseboat on this oddly raging river with a very nondescript background. You can see the limit of the budget here. It's just, like I said, I don't have much to say, but it's silly. It looks terrible.
I have plenty to say. That crash is insane. That crash is like they put the houseboat into a fucking blender.
Yeah. What is it in the Poltergeist where the house folds up into itself and goes into like a bubble? That's what happens to this boat. It hits the Poltergeist and just sucks up into its own butthole.
It's insane what happens to that boat.
I can't explain it physically. Like at first I'm like, wow, this is a hell of a wreck, but it just kept on going on. I'm like, how compacted can this fucking houseboat get? And and I'm like, well, Jessica Lange and Juliette Lewis are fucking dead. And like everyone's.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have Robert De Niro just floating on like a little 6-foot section of it. Like, it's like if you took, if a houseboat's a house and you just like melon ball scoop the bathroom out of it, that is what's left floating on the river.
It's pretty cool. I like it. It was wild, man. That shot blew my mind. It's the best effect shot in the entire movie because I don't know how they did it. I really don't know how they did it.
True.
They turned a houseboat into matchsticks in a matter of 3 seconds from it hitting a rock.
Yeah, it's improbable and kind of amazing, kind of awesome. And there's this insane... Also, the camera work in this final fight where it's just like... At some point, how am I trying to say this? You've seen Star Trek when the bridge takes damage and the camera's doing one thing and the actor's doing one thing.
Oh, yeah.
Martin Scorsese says, hold my beer. He spins that camera 360 around its viewing axis every time the ship takes a wave. And it's the most disorienting thing in the world. He's just like, the wild swings he was doing with the camera to like sell the motion and the kinetic. And it, for whatever reason, it just didn't work. It just felt kind of like shoddy and kind of like, this is kind of a boring bad action sequence. And we need to just go for broke with the camera movement so people can't tell.
This is the thing. It was a problem for me in Age of Innocence as well. I'm not sure necessarily exactly what Scorsese is trying to say with his flares of cinematography. He seems to be doing them simply to do them in a lot of scenes. I sort of get like the negative image stuff.
Because it's very Hitchcockian, very 60s thriller.
Like half the shit he's trying to pull is just, I don't know, throw a weird effect in there because that's the reputation I have.
Right. Yes. It's like, it's not Scorsese enough.
It's not Scorsese enough. Give me more Scarzy. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
I have so many more questions.
Okay, hit me with one, because I got like one more.
Okay, there's the whole sequence with them locking down the house, right? And to me, I was like, okay, I see what's going to happen here. What he's going to do is he's going to go fly on his business trip or whatever, or not a business trip. He needs to save his career. So he's going to go out and fly to this hearing. He's going to hire Joe Don Baker to come in and protect the family while he's gone. Well, half of that is true. He does hire him, but he doesn't go to the hearing, so he's going to lose his career anyway, right? His career is shot.
Which is why they say he's a fugitive, because he didn't show up. Like, towards the end of the movie, they say he's a fugitive when he's going to a houseboat because he skipped this hearing.
Oh, okay. I thought it was because he had murdered Joe Don Baker and rolled around in his blood and fired the murder weapon.
Oh, is that what? Okay, is that what it was?
Maybe I couldn't really tell you because I don't know how they would have found the body that quick. But
yeah, no, I thought it was like they were calling, like, you never showed up to your hearing. But just to be clear, this is a bar association. The stakes are you get disbarred. The stakes aren't you're gonna have a bench warrant sworn out and you're gonna be arrested. I don't think.
No, you're just not gonna be able to practice law.
Right. That's it. It's like you just forfeit your life. So then that you're right. At the end of this movie, what the fuck? Okay. Anyway, yeah, we haven't even got to your thing yet. Let's get to your thing.
Yeah. No, I got two things here. So it's totally unconscionable to bring the maid into this situation, right? Like, hiring the maid to keep up appearances means that she is in a very dangerous situation, and it ends up in her murder.
She gets murdered. Yeah. Send her home.
Give her the day off, man. You think Max Katie's not going to show up because the maid's not there? No. This is his opportunity to strike.
Let's send the housekeeper home. I'll wear a dress. I'll wear a wig.
There you go.
Men can beat him in his own game, right? Still be masculine.
Could you imagine if he goes to kill the maid and he turns around and is Nick Nolte?
they're both Miss Doubtfiring. Yeah,
dueling Miss Doubtfires. That'd be amazing.
Dueling Doubtfires. We need Robert De Niro to come back. Oh damn, we don't have Robin Williams.
Let's remake this movie.
If Robin Williams had not succumbed to depression and killed himself, we could have a Dueling Doubtfires with a 70-year-old Robin Williams and in a spoof movie
of Cape Fear. Oh boy,
and he's trying to out. They're both trying to, like, Robin Williams trying to infiltrate his family to save it, and Robert De Niro trying to infiltrate the family to kill it.
Caped out.
Cape Fire.
Cape Fire, yes. Cape Fire. And that's just how you say fear in a southern accent, right? Cape Fire.
Cape Fire. Yeah. That's how Robert De Niro says it.
Jesus Christ. Okay, one other question about that scene. Nick Nolte.
Well, so yeah, you have a good question. So Nick Nolte is a fugitive from the law for either ducking his bar association review or the police showing up and seeing that he's murdered his maid and his private eye associate and his murder. So at the end of this movie, his family is together, but they're going to stand trial for murdering two people. And also he's going to lose his job as a high powered. Like, what, in what way are they together? Ah, yeah.
Unless they claim, like, oh, Joe Don Baker broke into our house and we had the right to kill him because of it. Because that's the whole premise of, like, why they're doing this plan is because if Katie breaks into their house, they can legally murder him. So maybe they're just going to say that. Like, Joe Don busted into our house and I garroted him.
That's right.
I pulled a string out of our piano and I cut his throat with it. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing I don't understand about that scene. Nick Nolte, at some point during the scene, when he realizes Katie is in the house, he says, I guess now we know how the dog died. No, we don't. How did the dog die? Aaron, how did the dog die?
I mean, by some kind of Katie mischief,
but how did he get him? How did he get him? Because the movie claims that now we know. And I don't fucking know.
Yeah, my guess was he poisoned some meat and threw it over the wall. But yeah, I think they're just saying that, like, it's definitely Katie. I don't know.
I mean, we knew it was Katie. The dog didn't just spontaneously die, right? But
they didn't know because they couldn't prove it legally.
Sure.
I still don't know
how he got in the house. He used this final shot, with the loose window, maybe.
The final shot of this movie is terrible, too. Like, Juliette Lewis just staring at the camera as it goes negative and then washes red as she's given this unhinged, well, we were all fine after that, but we never talked about this day. It was too much to thin. You can fixate on death or you can live, and I choose to live. Like, what? God, why? Like, the movie's stronger without. There's a lot of curious choices. Did I learn that you can pick a man up by his neck?
Yes.
By cupping your hand like you're trying to drink water and, like, hooking their chin. And apparently, like, this. So Nick Nolte is just walking on the deck of his houseboat, and Robert De Niro just grabs his chin from underneath and just drags him onto the upper floor. Hold can be defeated by the natural instinct to look up at your attacker. If Nick Nolte just is like, what the hell, and just looks up, he's free.
Yeah.
But instead, he hooks his jaw to his chin so he could be hauled up. Oh, man. That's one of the funniest. I was rolling the last 10 or 15 minutes of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be terrifying, right? And to me, it's just kind of hilarious.
As soon as the houseboat broke loose... And it's clearly this shoebox size model on this raging river bathtub set. Like, it just never stopped being funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, kind of by the end of this movie, I just wanted it to be over. I'm like,
Yes.
Just fucking sink already. Stop singing. Just sink. Yep. You're gonna die. Like, yeah. What? Blood on your hands. It washes off. Whatever.
Oh God.
I don't care. Your metaphor is not worth the time after this movie.
The movie's only not even quite. Is it? Is it a little over 2 hours? It felt
it's
wrong.
Right at, yeah.
Like even though it's not really, because yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Like when he was going through and washing the blood off his hands, I'm like, oh my God, this is so kind of hack. And do you think that you would have gotten the fact that Max Cady was speaking in tongues had they not name checked speaking in tongues like 30-40 minutes
sure.
before? You think you would have? Okay.
In 1991, sure. Look, I was 9 years old. Maybe not. But nowadays, absolutely, of course.
Okay. Because I was like, what the fuck is he doing? Is he like drowning or what? And then I'm like, oh, right. They talked about speaking in tongues and his daddy drinking acid and all that crap. Okay.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. The end of this movie, they're all huddled up together, hugging each other. They've just floated out to the Atlantic Ocean for like an hour. How do they get back to civilization?
Dude, no clue. No
they're
clue.
Just like, and we lived happily ever after, never thinking about this moment again.
You.
Well,
I'm
show me the next 6 months of your lives where you guys are trying to get through the jungle full of, or the jungle, the swamp full of alligators and shit like that. How
and
did
then
you get
when
back?
When you finally show up at a diner and you try to, like, you're instantly arrested for the murder of like three people.
Right. Right, the maid,
your dad's
Jodan
been
Baker.
Disbarred. Your dad's been disbarred, and you got no money, and you probably lost your house, and yeah, I.
But at least you don't have blood on your hands, Aaron.
At least you don't have blood on your hands. And apparently, Nick Nolte quit fucking around after that, and Juliet Lewis was scared
straight.
And she was a mom. Yeah, and you know, mom got a new dog.
Sure, the daughter never learned its name.
Yeah.
I'm
it's
a man. I don't like this
it's
movie.
It's not a good movie. It's not a good movie. I did not. I was looking for it. I actually wasn't. Because remember last week when we were, I think this is off the record, but we were talking about like it's going to be Cape Fear. And I'm like, I bet this movie, I've never seen this movie, but I'm betting it's going to, and I laid out it and it's exactly what I thought it was. And that was like, I was kind of secretly hoping that the Scorsese of it would elevate it just a little bit. And if anything, it got. Like, I feel like this would have been a better thriller if someone not Scorsese, like, just got somebody to do it. Like, whoever was, like, the workman-like director of the 90s.
Because there wouldn't be this there. Alfred Hitchcock feel, like, I've got to go for that. And look, I've seen a red out before. I've never seen a yellow out. I guess that's, like, fade to yellow is weird, and I don't know what he's trying to say
she
with
had
it.
To pee.
But he's...
Robert De Niro wrecked her bathroom and it swept out to sea. She'd been holding her piss for like, I mean, how long did he have her locked into the hold? She's pee shy.
A while. And let me ask you this. Better or worse if Steven Spielberg makes it? Can you even imagine?
Better because like Steven Spielberg would not have gone fucking gonzo on some of the sexual violence. Would have like honestly, if Max doesn't bite that woman's cheek off and break her arm, I kind of buy that scene.
Hmm. Okay.
You know, like, well, he raped me and it's even maybe even but I don't want to have the whole floozy accusation. I don't want the guy. But like just the way they set that up and the way it was filmed is number one is just it's unpleasant to watch. And number two, the
for
way
sure.
it worked within the film was like, yeah, it just didn't fit. It just is a piece of the machine that was broken and didn't help the engine turn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I've seen gratuitous sexual violence that don't really serve the plot, but like I've never seen one actively go against like buck the tide of what the movie's trying to do.
Yeah, this is the only movie that I guess Julia Lewis has ever been nominated for an Oscar for, and I'm a little disappointed in that because I like Natural Born Killers, or at least I did when I saw it. Boy, I was
that's a much
that was a
better
long time ago.
Crazy
yes
girl movie for sure.
I agree. I think she's much better in it. And I don't know why this got so much acclaim from her. Like, maybe it's the duality of her, right? She's able
Wasn't
to play
that kind of the first thing she
super
did
innocent.
Too?
This is very early on. Yeah, this might be her first feature film.
I don't even think she was like 17 going on 18 in this movie.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good performance. It's just I've seen her do better, and she didn't get any nominations for that. So what the hell?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she did My Stepmother National. Oh, right. She's in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Oh, yeah. Never mind.
But she then was. Then right after that, she's in Cape Fear. So, like, if you had seen her as, like, you know, the Griswold daughter, and then she's sucking Robert De Niro's thumb and being terrorized by him in this movie, it's like, I guess that's a hairpin turn for an actor to take, maybe, and it really impressed.
Mm-hmm.
Really impressed people.
I suppose. Makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, that's Cape Fear. That's Cape Fear. We are going to be taking a hiatus from Prestige Movies.
Can I do one more thing here?
Of course, your podcast.
Before we leave, I got one more thing to ask you about. There's a scene where Robert De Niro first really meets up and talks with Nick Nolte, and he tells him, hey, look at you. You gained like 15 pounds, right? It's been 14 years. Mm-hmm. I lost a pound a year. You gained a pound a year. This is shitty to tell the actor who just lost a shitload of weight to take on this role. Boy, you look real puffy there, Nolte. Looking real bad. 14 extra pounds.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious. The meta of it.
Yeah, no, it's if anything, it's like the exact opposite. You know, De Niro put on like 20 pounds of muscle.
Right.
Nolte starved himself.
I have a hard time believing he only dropped 14 pounds in 14 years. A pound a year on prison food?
I mean, I tell you, he had zero body fat on him, though.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen him all kinds of body shapes, but like that first scene of him, like, doing those dips was pretty impressive. I had high hopes for the movie at that point. Let's put it that way. All right, are we done with Cape Fear now?
Yeah, I think so.
All done. This is going to be the final, or not the final. It's going to be the last Prestige movie for a while. Why? Because we're going to be talking about Showtime's Yellow Jackets, another Prestige thriller.
Speaking of Juliette Lewis.
With maybe they'll have a bunch of supernatural elements in it this year, and we'll look like fools. We'll look like fools for putting it in Prestige. But also, I think we're trying to, like, maybe re-envision for Prestige as just the overall kind of quality and aims of the project rather than its presence of aliens or, you know, spaceships and whatnot. We're going to see how it goes, because we've been doing Prestige movies for a long time, and we're going to continue to do them on first run and probably when we're in between Prestige projects. But oh my gosh, we've just been flooded with so much pulp. It's time to clear out the Prestige pipes. So we'll be doing that for the next couple months or so. Starting next week, we'll have the preview, if not the first episode. I'm not sure. This might be coming out 1 week in arrears. But yeah, we will be back to Prestige movies, I'm sure, before you know it. And again, maybe a first run movie or two will come out. And thanks for listening. Thanks for helping us pick these various projects. Maybe Cape Fear. What was Cape Fear running against, Jim? Maybe I can risk pissing off our executive producers. I'm going to take shots at them. Right. How'd you guys pick Cape Fear when you had these other two movies to pick from?
I really don't know, because the other two movies were In the Name of the Father, which is Daniel Day-Lewis, and Scent of a Woman. Hoo-ah! Come on.
We had Daniel Day-Lewis and Hoo-ah, and you sent us down the thumb-sucking path?
Right.
That's why we gave the exec producers too much power. They went drunk. They went mad. You guys got to sit on the bench for a couple. We got to figure things out. We're gonna do some. Just watch some Yellow Jackets and think about what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And also thank you for support. And we'll see you on the next one. Bye, guys.